seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
You're very welcome, Golf Weekly listeners. Once again, our apologies. You're very angry on Twitter. We can see that. But we are here now. And we are going to, despite the 2-3 week gap, we're going to look back on the Masters today. Nathan Murphy was down at the very brand spanking new Adair Manor, which was very exciting, and talked to the course architect, Tom Fazio. We've got New Orleans, Zurich Classic, and China Open this week. Interview with Stephanie Meadow as well. Nathan was speaking to Stephanie Meadow. And Nathan Murphy is here as well. Hello.
How are you?
They're not happy with us.
Who do we blame? Fiona, I'd say.
Fionn mainly.
Not here to defend himself.
Fionn's still not here.
I just don't think he cares about the Golf Weekly listeners. In fact, I'm fairly sure I got a WhatsApp last night saying, screw him.
Yeah. He texted me the other day saying, I hate ordinary people.
Oof.
You know, that's just Fionn. He's over in California.
He is forgetting, when it comes to Golf Weekly and the Golf Weekly community, we are the ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
The Golf Weekly listeners are generally far more successful in life than we are.
Yeah. Fiona's in California at the moment playing golf. He's on the junket to end all junkets, it seems. So it's understandable he would pick that instead of hanging out with us.
He's playing in some media competition
around
some of the best golf courses in California.
Mm-hmm.
And last we hear, he's leading, or his team is leading.
Is that right?
Yes.
I wasn't keeping that close an eye on things. But either way, we wish him well. There are some tweets in, so we'll get to your tweets firstly. Look, there's a lot of anger on Twitter at the best of times. We've borne the brunt of it over the last few weeks. There's a lot of snide comments about at Golf Monthly. You know, the classics, those ones.
We've heard that before. Many times, actually, unfortunately.
Mark Cunningham points out, Fionn was on BBC television. I mean, that's the big news. We'll have to talk about to Fionn about this very shortly. Fionn was on BBC News morning television for 4 minutes.
4 minutes.
Did you see the picture of him in his tie?
I did see the picture. Yeah. He made an effort.
He did, yeah. So he was on talking about tourism. And
he was talking about that beach in, is it the Philippines or Bali, that has come up several times on Golf Weekly.
Oh, how is he?
In recent weeks.
I didn't see his appearance.
So that's what he was talking about.
What
is the name of the beach? I can't think.
Something with a B.
So he was talking about that because I think they've either closed it down because of pollution or something like that.
Okay.
So which makes me wonder, how did they know Fionn was an expert on that?
Yeah.
Unless they listen to Golf Weekly.
Well, Mark Cunningham points out, at Golf Weekly OTB must be a fast track to making a career in television.
It's fine.
Ryan Connolly did a screen grab of Fionn. At Golf Weekly OTB, I want to look as good as at Fionn Davenport when I'm his age. Which I do as well.
We all do. And he's a big age right now.
5-0, and he just looks great. I mean, he looks like he could be 39, he looks like he'd be 40. 10 years younger at 50 is serious achievement for a man.
And he's also lived a life.
It's not clean living. It's
good
genetics which have done him. So well done, Fionn. Yeah, he did. I was WhatsApping him because I was away. I was in New York for a week. I just went for it. I
said, how was that?
It was amazing as it could get, really. And I was just texting from the airport when I was coming home, very depressed because I'd just seen he was on television. I was like, what's going on? You know? And you know, he was saying he'd been in touch with him a while back, and then he just got a shout out of the blue saying, we need you, come on in.
Boracay.
I knew it was a B. Well done. 9 million people. Just the 9 million.
Whew. Stick that up your Grand Slam.
That's what...
was he on with Dan Walker?
...has been doing. No. And it wasn't because it was a Sunday. He was just on with two other people. Tig Hegarty says, Fionn, this surely increases your appearance fee for Golf Weekly. Let's double Fionn's appearance fee.
Yeah. Treble it.
Yeah. Fionn did write back saying, from €0 to ? So P.O. Murphy Som said, looking sharp, Fionn. No doubt a few comments on the next pod. I mean, we are looking forward to getting in-depth with Fionn on his TV appearance at the on the next Golf Weekly. Where is Golf Monthly, wonders Frank Dolan. Wasn't happy. John Campbell, you are the Rory McIlroy of golf podcasts. Big fan, but sometimes disappointed.
Oof.
And he says, this is disgusting. He says he has a new soft spot for BBC's The Cut.
Never even heard of it.
Blocked, John. Blocked. Wow. I listened to some of The Cut during the Masters, did you?
This is Ian Carter's
new podcast.
Was that the first one at the Masters?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard some of it then.
What do you think?
I like Ian Carter.
Yeah, that was okay.
Yeah. It's no Golf Weekly.
No, it's no Golf. Look.
It's a BBC golf podcast. It's everything you would expect.
Mm-hmm. Bum, bum, bum. What am I looking for here? I'm just going through tweets live. Masters review will seem a bit dated by now, but I still refresh every day just in case, said Matt Banks on April 20th.
Are we in May yet? Almost.
Our Masters review has not got any
Do you know what would be interesting? If somebody arrived in now and gave us a quiz on the Masters.
I know.
How many things we can remember.
Who finished second?
Ricky Fowler.
Oh yeah, okay.
Remember Jordan Spieth?
Yeah. It's coming back to me now. Somebody else in touch. Oh yeah, so Adair Manor. There's a lot of people enjoying your Adair Manor situation.
None more than me.
Yeah. Sean92, I'm just going through these as I get to them. This was obviously in reply to you saying we don't have a Golf Weekly this week. He said, disruptions are inevitable. It's just disappointing you guys have been unable to capitalize on the momentum of the Masters and now the good golfing weather. Give the people what they want. Look, we're trying. There was only so much we could do. We actually had a great night on Masters Eve in Lushelstown.
Oh, we did.
Quite a few of the listeners. That was actually really, really good.
It was a very enjoyable day. Thanks everyone for coming along because we won't lie, at midday there was a few nervous conversations when we had 150 or about probably 100 people already there.
Yeah.
And the course was flooded. And the greenkeeper was saying, nobody's going out there today. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, Peter managed to work a way around. So we played, 14 holes?
Yeah.
And there wasn't a bit of water on.
No, it was very good. I would say Peter had to have a forceful enough conversation with the greenkeeper.
On behalf of the Golf Weekly listener.
Yeah. Mungo wrote back on April 24th saying, I was genuinely looking forward to a pod about the Masters from Hughes Lot. Well, our apologies. And that's pretty much us up to date. Just a lot of people. I've just flicked by a lot of people saying, lads, sorted out. Our sincere apologies. It's going to happen with us sometimes. There's nothing we could do. But we're worth the wait, right?
Hey, Joe, I have some breaking news.
Okay.
I've recently received an email in the past few minutes. So
are
there's some big golf tournaments coming up. There's some
serious?
Big golf tournaments coming up in the rest of 2018. Mm-hmm. There's the US Open.
Yeah.
The Open Championship, mm-hmm. the PGA, the Ryder Cup.
Heard of them.
But really, there's only one tournament.
I know where you're going with this.
Right here. Right here at the fields.
Yeah.
Because, Joe, Golf Weekly.
Yeah.
It's brought to you in association with the 2018 Dubai Duty Free Irish Open taking place at Ballyliffin Golf Club. County Donegal from July 4th to 8th. For more ticket information, visit DubaiDutyFreeIrishOpen.com. Imagine, we didn't screw it up enough last year that they've come back for more.
Is this for real?
This for real.
This literally has just happened.
This has just happened.
So we're now sponsored by the Irish Open again.
Yes.
Brilliant. That's breaking
news. Just in case you're watching, Fionn, that's still 0-0 for you.
Yeah. You'll get a cut, Fionn. Mm. A percentage cut. So we are now... Who sent that email?
Somebody upstairs.
What time was the email sent at?
They weren't quite sure if it was starting this week or next week, but I just love the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open Ballyliffin July 4 to 8 so much. Mm-hmm. I just thought I'd throw it in as a freebie.
Yeah.
Like, they did... I don't want to say this, but they didn't even need to pay us.
No.
We just mentioned it anyways.
Okay, so we in future now we are brought to you by the Dubai Duty.
We're going up again, Joe. Full week.
Yeah.
Prime place. Mm-hmm. All those people who like to come and knock on the window when we're on air.
Well, let's see what happens in the program, my friend.
I don't get to make these big decisions, Joe.
Oh, dear. Right, okay. So, they are your tweets. I haven't done them very well, I appreciate it. We're going to pick things up here. So, we're going to talk Masters in a few moments. Adair Manor was genuinely interesting. Obviously, McGinley, Lowry, Harrington, and McIlroy were there. And there is golf this weekend, the team of golf from the Zurich Classic, where we have Lowry and Harrington playing together. Round 1 and 3 are four ball, best ball. Rounds 2 and 4 are foursomes, alternate shot. That's the format of this thing. And actually, in the on and off the ball, I mean, people have complained we podcast off the ball golf stuff on the podcast. So they would have heard Shane Ryan talking about Patrick Reed. They would have heard Paul McGinley talking about the Masters. They would have heard Shane Lowry in here with Peter Lowry.
Mm.
So we've been keeping things ticking over on the golf front. One other thing to say before we get into Masters was, I'm reading the new Tiger Woods book.
Mm.
So I'm going to, well, I think we should sit down and I'll do a full report to the class, review some of the best anecdotes. You know,
what do you got so far?
I mean, it's really turning me off Tiger. You know, I wanted Tiger to win the Masters a few weeks ago, as much just for the, it'd be such a big story as anything. But just, I thought, you know, he's been through a lot in his own weird way.
Mm.
The general thesis of the book, I think, is that his parents ruined him. And not just by not giving him a life and just having him on a driving range all the time and everything, but actually they imbued him with this attitude that because from the age of 2, 3, 4, 5, he was effectively already an elite athlete, that he didn't really have to obey the rules. He didn't really have to say thanks. He didn't really have to be polite. He didn't really have to pay for stuff. So like, the book has interviewed a couple hundred people. So Tiger's first two coaches, we've never heard of, I hadn't heard of until the book, were never paid a cent and got very little thanks. Tiger's first coach was a guy who was in his early 30s at the driving range that was near the house, and his mother, who by the way always called Phil Mickelson, Fat Phil. How's Fat Phil? How's Fat Phil doing? Not a fan of the Mickelsons. Fat Phil, ooh, Fat Phil crying. Was the kind of thing. Yeah, very funny. Fat Phil. But they went up to the driving range when he was 5 or 6, when Earl thought, okay, he needs a bit more help than I can give him. And they called in the guy who wouldn't have been making a lot of money, the driving range pro, and they said, come and look at our son. We want you to give him lessons for free. And he thought, okay. But then went out and saw a swing that had the same technical range of a pro almost, and he said to himself, okay, I'll help, great. And they just used him for a few years and then ditched him. They got a guy at a nicer place up the road, a country club, and he saw Tiger and said, yeah, okay, I'll work with him. But again, they never paid him. So Tiger was taught all these lessons from very young, that he didn't really have to treat people with much respect. Stuff just kind of came his way. He didn't have to pay for meals.
Entitled.
Yeah, to a point. And so the most recent story I read this week, I'm up every night till about 2 reading this book. It's a real page turner. And I'm in the midst of the affairs and the sex scandal now. It's unbelievable. 120 women is the report. I mean, I knew there were like...
While he was married?
Yeah.
Wow.
It started so much earlier, it seems, according to this book, than we'd all thought. I thought maybe, okay, the first few years are fine. I don't get the impression there was ever a point where it was fine. He was in the habit of going to Vegas, going to New York, VIP table, point out the girls he liked, the nightclub owner would go over and say, Tiger Woods would like your company at the table, a few drinks, and bada bing, bada bang. And that was his way of rolling. But look, it was obviously horrific, but Hank Haney described him on the Golf Channel as a sex addict, and his behavior was just so joyless at times when it came to sex that it was weird. Like there was something at play there. So who knows what was going on? But the stuff actually, which almost has registered more with me and has made me think, I don't know if I can like this guy, is the level of rudeness. So a very simple story is he's very good friends with Mark O'Meara. They live in Isleworth together, loves the O'Meara family. O'Meara's got a beautiful wife, blonde, beautiful, great family thing. In some respects, they wonder in the book if Tiger said, I want to replicate that, you know? Anyway, good friends with the O'Meara's. The O'Meara's always rent a house at Augusta from the same woman. And the O'Meara's are lovely people. They've got to know her over the years. She vacates her house for the week, supplements her annual income with a big hefty paycheck from the O'Meara's. Everyone's a winner. And Woods, when he started playing at Augusta, O'Meara said, we have a spare room, just stay with us. Obviously, Tiger didn't offer much money, any money to do that. He's incredibly cheap. The PGA Tour would go around and tip people in the locker room $100 because Woods would never give any tips. And they were almost like mortified that he was winning $1 million at times and was not tipping the guy who looked after him all week. So they, on his behalf, almost just said, that's from Tiger. Yeah. Anyway, it's the year O'Meara wins Augusta. Tiger's delighted for him. Like, he does love O'Meara. He's as happy for O'Meara as he is for himself when he wins almost. He's there to meet him at the 18th. They go back to the house. They know there's a champions dinner that night. They get to go back for a celebration dinner, a bit like Wimbledon. And it seems O'Meara's up getting ready. Tiger is ready. And O'Meara's wife is next door because, again, the O'Meara's been nice people. They've got to know the next door neighbor down the years. So O'Meara's wife is in next door. And it seems Tiger needs to go in and check what time they're leaving at. And Mark is still back at the house getting ready. So he goes in and Mark O'Meara is there chatting to the neighbours. Mark O'Meara's wife is there chatting to the neighbours, doing some champagne or whatever. And there's a few other people there. And one of them stands up and says, Tiger, hi, I think her name was Ruth, I'm not sure. I'm Ruth, say it's Ruth. I'm Ruth. It's my house you've been staying in all these years with the O'Meara's. I just popped in because I'm delighted, I'm thrilled. It's great to meet you seeing as you've been staying at the house all that time. Tiger looks at her, turns to Mark O'Meara's wife and says, Mark wants to know what time we're leaving at. And leaves the house.
Wow.
And the woman was just left mortified, embarrassed, like, I don't even know what spectrum that behavior is on. That was just odd. It wasn't like if he talked to me, he would then have to talk to 1,000 people. Stuff like that almost registers more when you're reading the book than woman number whatever on his hit list.
Have they spoken to that woman?
Yeah, because they've interviewed a few hundred people. They've done a good job, it seems, research-wise.
Well, Mark Steinberg said they never reached out to us, so...
They did.
And they came back and said, well, actually, here's
the questions.
Numerous examples.
Yeah. Yeah, they reached out numerous times. And then actually to round off that even just tiny aspect of Tiger Woods' life, the Augusta place where he stayed, he kept renting the house afterwards from the woman and left it in an appalling state every time. Like, they had to get cleaners, professional cleaners in. It was left in such a terrible state. And then they found that 1 year when Ellen was there, they'd made a ton of long distance calls to Sweden, like a big phone bill, and hadn't left any cash just to cover that, to the point where the woman got on to Tiger Woods' people and said, like, the house is a state. The Amir has never left it like this. It's an absolute state. This happens every time. And you've left me with a massive phone bill. And so Woods' people, like, he's getting $100 million a year at this stage. He's just on the verge of becoming a billion-dollar athlete for the first time. They say, okay, print out the bill and post it to us. Grand. They send the bill back with highlighted the long-distance calls and to the penny, like 70,
wow,
whatever, and 71 bloody cents hell comes back. And the woman's thinking, God, was it worth my hassle? So I think by the end of this book, I'm now going to be rooting. I'm going to be compelled by Tiger and really want to watch him and see can he win. But I just can't now be any way happy for him. I think I'm an antibody.
But is that
Tiger
not the
guy.
Old Tiger? And there's a new,
well,
fresher, more friendly version.
Funny, I'm at an interesting point. I'll wrap up the Tiger chat for now and we'll do it again in a bit more depth. I'm at the point now where he's come out of his treatment for addiction and I'm curious to see if people buy the new Tiger. Is the guilt genuine? Is it all for real? So
suddenly not offering Hank Haney an ice cream doesn't seem so bad.
Do you know what? When you read this book, it's like, God, well, I wouldn't have expected anything else. Like, if he had offered Hank Haney an ice cream, it would have been weird. His parents did a number on him. And obviously, Earl is a dreadful man.
That's been clear from a long way out.
Very grim. Very grim. Tiger definitely hated Phil as well. Phil.
Yeah. Next week's pod should be interesting as we try and get it past the lawyers.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I don't know how much of all of this you can even say.
Do you get it in America?
I bought it on Kindle, so I don't know where I've got it from. I presume they must GPS know where I am and therefore give me the European version. But I don't know, maybe I've got the American version. Like, there's plenty of stuff in it that I'm sure Woods would like to deny.
Yeah.
You know what? They've done a great job. Lots of interesting bits and pieces. EA Sports used the scandal. For years, there was like, can we have anyone else on the cover, even with Tiger on the PGA Tour? No chance. It's me every time, and it's no one else. And so you'll notice around the time of the scandal, when he was losing all the sponsors, it's then that Rory McIlroy is on the front cover of the game because the EA Sports said, we may not cancel our arrangement, our sponsorship, but this whole front cover business, we're cancelling that. They wanted, when they first started the EA Sports game, they wanted you to be able to drive the ball 500 yards as a like cool computer thing. And Woods, I think quite rightly said, absolutely not. We're going for realism. I can hit a 340 with the wind. It will not go further than 340 in this game.
Okay.
I think it's the right choice.
Yeah.
What would be the point in hitting 500 yards? I don't know. They're thinking maybe they...
It's going to be realistic.
Yeah. Anyway, are there any other Tiger Woods questions you want to ask me?
No, I'll save it till next week. I might just download the book.
I recommend it. It's proper, when you get into it, it's proper page turner. And for nerds like us, every 2 or 3 pages has something where you're like, oh my God, oh my God, kind of a thing. It's full of great detail and anecdotes. It's really, really good. So let's turn to the Masters. So it's a while ago now, our apologies. I guess to a point this is our Masters review. I had clearly forgotten that Ricky Fowler had finished second. That's slightly embarrassing. I had forgotten that, obviously, that great back nine in particular. I mean, really, it was about Reed and McIlroy. Can I ask you, we're not going to pick our way through all the aspects of this tournament, but on Patrick Reed, I almost felt like coming to his defence on Off the Ball that week and getting Shane Ryan on, who had written the stuff about Patrick Reed and slaying the Tiger, which almost generated a lot of the Patrick Reed's not a nice guy, he allegedly cheated, he allegedly stole a college. I don't know, maybe because we were just like familiar with it all, it seemed like it was almost unfair that on the greatest day of his life, the two stories going on about Patrick Reed were, well, he's an asshole, and secondly, with the cooperation of his parents, unfortunately, I don't know what they were thinking with Alan Shipnuck, here's the nitty gritty of his family situation, which is terribly sad. And so the golf public were aware of this and weren't that blown away by it. But I guess every kind of casual I watch the majors type golf fan was going, oh my God, on everywhere. Have you seen this? Sharing it, retweeting
you
it.
You bad boy of
I
golf.
I hate this guy. Yeah. And a part of me thought this has gone a bit too far.
Does it show how bland golf has got for the general sports fan that Jordan Spieth, Mr. Nice Guy, Justin Thomas, these are all sort of, in many ways, aside from their unbelievable sporting prowess, nothing really stands out about them. So suddenly there is something to latch onto. I was stunned by the interest levels and just how it really evolved over the 4 or 5 days afterwards that suddenly this guy is public enemy number one. Now, we've spoken about him a lot over the last couple of years, and we've spoken to Shane Ryan, and we've gone into the dirty detail.
Yeah.
And even then I was going, okay, he doesn't sound like a nice individual. There's enough of a body of evidence to suggest that this isn't one or two people who don't like him.
Yeah.
That actually, there's a lot of stuff has gone on. But still,
yeah,
he stole. He cheated. Didn't murder anybody.
No. Michael Vick's having dogs fight each other. The NFL has a lot of domestic abuse issues, and guys are welcome back in, and there's not much fuss. This guy hit the wrong ball out of the rough. Now, I know in a sport like golf, that's very, very bad. But, I mean, I was watching it, and even, like, I was talking to Shane Ryan on Off the Ball, and you have to say, a lot of these stories are 6, 7, 8 years old from his college days when undeniably he was a selfish brat and like he seemed like an odd kid. He seemed like socially awkward or unaware and overly defined by his golf and therefore incredibly arrogant about his golf and not a nice person for sure. But I mean, we don't fully know, has he matured? He's got married. Okay, the family thing is another aspect, but he may have matured. He may just be a bit of a loner on tour. Like quite a few guys spoke up and said, look, it's been a bit over the top. He just sort of keeps himself to himself kind of territory.
Well, Matt Kuchar stood at the back of the 18th, which I thought was noteworthy because it is Matt Kuchar.
I didn't see that.
Such a nice guy.
I didn't see Kuchar
standing there. And was speaking with Patrick Reed's wife as he was about to putt on 18. Which I sort of felt, and I don't know how close their relationship is. Obviously, they played Ryder Cups together. But maybe Kuchar feeling, well, is anybody going to go out there?
Yeah.
Somebody better go out. Somebody better show that this isn't Patrick Reed against the rest of us. It did seem to get a bit over the top. We're on the verge of front cover of Sports Illustrated being,
Mr. Evil.
This the most hated man in sport right now?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people have done a hell of a lot worse.
Yeah.
Including some people we've spoken about.
Yeah.
Quite recently.
That was my feeling.
So is it that, like, how do we judge our sports people? You can do whatever the hell you want off the course, but or off the court, whatever, pitch, whatever. But as long as you don't cheat on the course, as Patrick Reed has been accused of, and steal from your teammates, that this is the one step too far that is totally unforgivable. And then I think maybe what brought it to another level was the family story.
Yeah, that was terrible.
And his family been removed from the 18th at a US Open.
Yeah.
And his family happy to talk about it, and he never talks about it.
Yeah, Shane Ryan made the point, and it struck me as well. We're getting, it seems like, a quite simplistic view of things, as in the narrative that the family have painted is everything was great, everything was superb. Evil wife comes along, turns our Patrick's head, takes his money, brings him over to the dark side, and we're heartbroken. That may be the case, but until he's spoken about it, and look, whose family isn't a bit complicated?
Well, you've just gone through the most famous sports person in the world and his backstory with his family.
Yeah.
And it gets written about and talked about in golf circles. I would say to the average sports person, and you were asking about Tiger Woods' upbringing, they wouldn't know a huge amount about Earl Woods.
No.
They would think, oh yeah, pushy parent.
Yeah.
They wouldn't know any of the deep, really dark stuff that went on there.
Yeah.
Yet suddenly this is this, whoo, maybe it's soap opera. People like a little bit of something to distract them.
People were just rubbernecking and getting the gossip.
I don't have an issue with it being covered and with people going back saying all these accusations were there 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
It was just the level of interest I was definitely taken aback by.
I guess for a lot of people, it was their first time hearing about it. So, yeah, I must say, look, I mean, when we first heard about it from Shane Ryan, I mean, it was quite exciting and it's titillating.
But it was gossipy. It was gossipy. More than anything.
Yeah. But I would say it took away from his experience of winning. The golf he played was pretty impressive because Sunday was tough for him. It was a real grind for him. He didn't have his best stuff. And unlike Rory, who we'll get onto in a second, man, he found a way to pull it out of the bag. The put on 12 was a huge moment for him from memory. He made a great putt there, a great save, or maybe it was a birdie. But he had some big moments on the back nine. I can't quite remember all the details that were really, really impressive. He felt the pressure.
Mm.
You know, this was not a guy who waltzed his way home. He felt the pressure from the first.
Yeah, he was clearly walking down the first very nervous, understandably so.
Yeah.
But I think Rory probably helped him, that Rory never put the pressure on, so therefore he was able to stay that little bit calmer. The predicted surge that Rory had spoken about on Saturday night just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And also, he's a very good golfer. Like, he has won a lot of PGA Tour events over the last 4 or 5 seasons. He had a little bit of luck. There were putts that he hit very hard that hit the hole and stopped 3 feet away, and he's able to save par, particularly I'm thinking 17, where he, I think, got quite fortunate. Was it 16 or 17 he got quite
flag
fortunate?
With the chip.
Yeah, so things like that fall in your favour. But he put it brilliantly. Yeah. And there was one stat I saw afterwards that shows how tight the margins are. So I think he had something like 104 putts over the 4 days. But he had 2 3 putts. Ricky Fowler had 3 3 putts. Jordan Spieth had 4 3 putts.
Right.
They finished 1 shot and 2 shots behind. So it all comes down to 1 3 putt for one player and just reducing the amount of them you have.
Yeah.
The excitement was because, and why it was such a, I don't know if you'd call it a great Masters, it was an enthralling Masters, because Spieth was on the verge. Until the back nine, you always thought Rory was going to turn it around. And then Ricky Fowler was still there at the very end and could have stolen in for a playoff. It was more the sense that somebody's going to deny Reed, whereas I don't know if Reed ever felt. It was a strange ending.
A little bit.
The shot to 18, and we all know 18 of the Masters and where you should hit it and where you shouldn't do on the final day. And when he hit it up there on the left-hand side on the ridge, I was kind of, oh, that looks like a good shot.
It was.
But there was this stony silence. And I was thinking, oh, well, actually, maybe it's so quick down there that actually this is going to be a really tough two-putt. Mm. And that all the patrons understand that, and those of us sitting, because that's not actually a spot that in recent times players have ended up in, certainly on the final day.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought that was part of the overall odd atmosphere. Like, he didn't get the best reception on one compared to Rory. McGinley was on, and we both thought watching it that maybe someone hadn't put up the fader on the TV feed. It was like stony silence. Like, it surely deserved a round of applause. He didn't go 30 feet into the rough.
No.
I just wonder if they're all the hardcore Augustonians who know the Reed family down the road, and the whole thing was just a bit awkward. Because even his reception when he won it was lukewarm. And there was that standing ovation where, oh, they're standing up, I better stand up. There was a moment when Jordan Spieth was on a run and they cut to the 18th and the scoreboard was changed. And it was like, I think it might be when he made the birdie on 16. Mm,
and it was a huge roar. He was within one.
The place went ballistic. And Reed wins the tournament and the place. Polite applause.
Now, I haven't heard anything since, and you don't want to get too much into rumour and speculation. I do just wonder, is there something still that we haven't heard about that everybody else knows?
In the area, yeah.
That there is another level to this that people feel they can't publish. Mm. Because I just don't think everything we've heard should be enough to make him public enemy number one at the Masters of all bloody places.
Yeah, I agree. It's very strange. So the speed thing was just phenomenal. He's a complete freak of nature. It was hilarious. It was just funny. I got goosebumps in 16 when he made the birdie.
Oh.
I will never doubt him again. He's just the greatest golfer out there. He's compelling. So Rory then, like you mentioned, Rory never really put the pressure on Reed. The second was a total sliding doors moment. The par five, he launches it in and you think, my God, he's going for this. And then he's got a 3-4 footer. Admittedly, it's very tricky and slippery downhill. For eagle, he said afterwards, I couldn't trust my stroke, my putting stroke. By the 10th, he was out of it, it felt to me. Mm. By the 11th, he was gone. He was out of the tournament.
Well, it happened so quickly. I do remember looking at the leaderboard around the 11th, 12th and thinking, oh, well, Rory could eagle 13, 15. Maybe he's... And it's like, wait a second. He needs to both eagle 13, 15 and have three more birdies to have any chance of winning this thing.
Yeah. So it struck me as his most disappointing final day. Way more disappointing than 2011 at the Masters when he's a kid. And he said, look, it's bonus territory and he screwed up. But
I asked him that down at Adair Manor.
Did you? Right.
How he would compare the disappointment of 2011 to this one. Because he said 2011 was the most important day of his golfing career. And he didn't feel that way. He was like, I'd never won a major at that stage. To be in contention on the back nine, you're going to learn so much. That this was a different experience.
This was worse?
No, this will be far easier to take.
Okay.
This belief that he's going to go and win the Masters. He has four majors in the bag already. That he, at least he knows he has that. He knows he can go and win majors. Whereas a part of him, maybe after Augusta in 2011, doesn't know if this is the sort of thing that alters your career forever, that maybe mentally you just can't recover from.
That's interesting. I don't know. For me, it was more disappointing because he has gone away. He has spent 3-4 months getting his game together. Mm. He's got the ball right. He's got the equipment right. It seemed like everything was in place. Admittedly, look, I don't know if Harry Diamond's going to be in the bag long term, but he seemed happy enough with his setup. And also on the first 3 days, the putting was good, like really good, like his short game. And last the year before short game was very good as well, but the putting was good. Paul McGinley did a thing in Sky. He was releasing the putter. It was flowing. He was a bit like when he won a couple of weeks before. It was more the artist than the scientist. All this kind of stuff we talked about was happening up until Saturday. And like Saturday, by the way, was one of the greatest evenings of golf of all time. Like it was just, it was incredible. It was wet and the course was there for the taking and they took it. But for it to desert him on Sunday, after all the good stuff and the 4, 5, 6 months of putting this whole thing into place, it struck me as, God, that is his most disappointing day.
That he's looking back and thinking, well, actually...
Well, no stone
is
was left
all
unturned.
That work worthwhile at the biggest moment it lets me down.
Yeah, in 2011 he wasn't equipped maybe. Mm. And I know he won the US Open at a canter then, but like he was still a kid, he was still finding his bearings. I'm saying this is his most disappointing because actually he's done everything right. Everything is in place. We've talked about the constant excuses over the last number of years. There was no excuse here. Ty, you know, you're ready to go and your putting has been good for the first 3 days and you're sitting there on the Sunday saying, I couldn't trust it. And maybe in 6 months it beds in more and he can trust it a whole lot more, but I just thought that's a bit scary. Really scary. Is he going to have to win this thing on a Saturday night?
Quite possibly. Or win it by he's in the clubhouse and somebody blows up and ultimately in 50 years' time nobody remembers that. All they remember is he's won the career Grand Slam.
By the way, he's so good he can win it on a Saturday. Very few players you could say that about. He is still my favourite golfer. He could win it on a Saturday.
And he has 32 more attempts at the Masters to go, more than likely.
Yeah.
I, on the Friday night, I remember WhatsApping somebody and I wasn't sure whether he was on the verge of playing unbelievably well, that he got himself into position and his game, he was holding something back and he was going to explode, which he kind of did on the Saturday, or whether he was just about keeping it together. And maybe it was a bit of both because the course was so easy on Saturday. The putting, maybe it's just that Sunday, the Masters, the career Grand Slam, if ever your weakness is going to be exposed, it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
I felt he got Saturday night wrong. I think we were talking about this at the time.
Being so bullish.
Like, it was brilliant. As somebody sitting at home watching the press conference and watching the interviews, I was like, bloody hell.
All the pressure's on Reed.
I just thought it was totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
You're the best golfer in the world on your day. Say nothing.
Yeah.
Just go out and beat him. He knows all this. There's no way anything you say can heap more pressure on Patrick Reed. Oh, God, I'm leading the Masters. And Rory's just reminded me that I'm leading the Masters.
I'd forgotten.
Everybody in the world knows that Patrick Reed is leading the Masters. And following up from the Ryder Cup and the way they both got a bit carried away.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Patrick Reed won.
Yeah.
And they both played terribly on the back nine. Like, the...
ran out of gas.
They both ran out of gas. You look at Rory and does he want to be a soccer player or does he want to be where you can actually use your emotion and your energy and you can pulverize the opposition and you want to get built up. You know, you're going out for a Champions League final. You want to be up for this. That he looks at other sports people and he wants that. Mm. Whereas actually, unfortunately, in golf, you just can't have that.
Yeah.
So
I couldn't work out what he was doing either. It seemed...
It felt like he was too pumped.
Yeah, and McGinley on Monday on Off the Ball was saying he would be very curious, and he didn't know, and I'm sure he's asked Rory actually, because he said it several times in the interview. He was very curious as to what Rory did on Saturday night. McGinley was saying, I want to know, did he get away from the course? Because he was saying he did a lot of media.
Mm.
He was there like a good hour and a half to 2 hours still doing media after his final round. And he wants to know, did he get home? Did he get a shower? Did he get a massage? Did he have a nice good meal? Did he come down? Because McGinley said he's far less worried about the putting. Now, who the hell am I? But I disagree. I still think the putting was a big issue. McGinley just feels ultimately he probably ran out of steam somewhere between Saturday night and the high of Saturday and then all the press and then being bullish, G'ing himself up as much as anything. And he thought he just came out Sunday and he was just empty. And it's funny, Peter Laurie was saying he felt Rory played too many practice rounds.
Mm.
Maybe Peter Laurie is kind of sitting there thinking, yeah, I think he peaked too early in that week. Who knows? But that was the McGinley thing. But certainly on Saturday night, was he talking to himself as much as anything? Was he trying to get himself up? That's what you're kind of saying?
I don't remember too many other golfers coming out after a third round.
Calling the other out.
And calling the other one out and trying to turn it into some sort of a match play type scenario when Reed has just beaten you in a big match play type scenario. I just felt for Rory, trust yourself here.
Mm.
You don't need to do this. You just need to go out and go, hey, it's a great opportunity for me. It's a great opportunity for Patrick.
Yeah.
Let's see how it all plays out tomorrow. That's very boring for all of us watching.
Yeah.
And we never remember it. And we never talk about that press conference again. But we probably do talk about him delivering then on the Sunday.
I guess scoreboard journalism, if he came out and smoked Reed, you'd say, God, and that press conference.
When Rory puts the pressure on, nobody can cope.
So it's benefit of hindsight stuff. But it was very noticeable that he did it. Any other final thoughts on Masters before we get to Adair?
I'm sure there's lots of great things happened over the course of that week.
That's the stuff that stayed with us. In some way, that makes it a more authentic review of the Masters. It's the stuff which has endured.
Mm. Ricky Fowler, does this get rid of some of the question marks?
I think so.
Mm.
It's interesting. Butch was saying, and McGinley was talking about it as well on air, in practice, they've made a real effort now when he's playing to make him focus on every single shot. So Butch is in, when he's messing around in the cart, Butch is almost saying, no, you have to pretend this is like, there's everything on the line with every shot. That's what they seem to be working on at the moment. Yeah, and like in his post-round interview, he had a bit of a snipe back, presumably at Butch. This is for people who say, I can't do it on the back nine of a Sunday.
My coach.
Yeah, who I know Tim Barter is listening to this, and I can. So, hey, look, I mean, he has to win a major, surely, at some point. And equally, Rory has to win a Masters, surely, at some point. But that wouldn't be the first time we've said that about golfers.
That's why I often wonder, I'd love to go back to Greg Norman and
how
many Masters is Greg Norman going to win?
What did they say in 96 even? Did they say that he might be approaching his last chance? Like, look, I'm not worried about, you can't worry about Rory because he's so brilliant, but you know, there's another generation coming and then there's another generation
coming. Well, all four major winners are aged under 27.
That's the concern. And you just run out of chances. Like, even reading the Tiger book, it's obscene to think in 06, 07, 08 that he was not going to win another major.
Mm.
Now, I know that's especially an odd case, what happened there. But you just, he's right not to be too down, of course, but it just struck me 2018 was such a chance for him. I mean, why not win three Masters? Like, even if he only wins two, then I still think in 40 years he should think to himself,
he'll look back at that one.
Really should have won 2018.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, Spieth. There was something. I was off my feet when that putt went in on 16.
Yeah. I think maybe we should think about having Jordan Spieth as the cover of our Golf Weekly podcasts and pitch. Like, maybe he's our guy.
We don't know why it's good. It just is.
Yeah. Righty, that is our Masters review. Your tweets to @GolfWeeklyOTB. We're going to finish up with some thoughts on Adair Manor. Where you were.
So I don't remember much about the Masters, but I can talk you through every moment of my time at Adair Manor, who have not paid me for any of this, but did let me indulge in the 5-star resort and in the golf course, which, as I said last Friday morning, is probably the best parkland golf course in Europe. Dave McIntyre WhatsApped me straight away and said, how many parkland courses have you played outside of Ireland?
Fair question.
So it is a very fair question. I can only give my sense
that
this was so far ahead of any other golf course I have ever played.
For people outside the country, Adair Manor hosted Irish Opens. It's a very well-regarded golf course owned by JP McManus, a Limerick man, very wealthy man, has made his fortune in various ways. And it seems they decided initially just to upgrade the course here or there, a few bunkers, a few bits and pieces, and the whole thing blossomed under Tom Fazio into a complete redesign. They've spent 80, 90 million kind of territory. A lot of money.
A lot of money. An unlimited budget. We'll hear from Tom Fazio in a moment.
Right. And the plan and is to host the Ryder Cup.
That is the... Now, JP McManus said it wasn't the stated aim, but it'd be nice.
Yeah.
Keith Pelly was there, the CEO of the European Tour. So too was George O'Grady. It was that kind of event.
JP McManus is an influential man. When he had his last pro-am at Adair, Tiger Woods was there.
Not just Tiger Woods. More of the world's top 50 than playing some world golf championships.
Like a major.
And the question was been asked, so it's back in 2020.
Yeah.
And every single penny goes to charity.
Are we going
to
play
every single penny.
Will we be famous enough by 2020?
That should be the aim.
I actually think that is now my aim in life.
That is
to get famous enough.
You will be.
Another few Six Nations might in the bag might get me over the line.
You need Irish rugby to stay on this.
If you win the World Cup. Two more Grand Slams.
Have you got the World Cup?
I think there's a tendering process still.
Okay.
That could be it.
That could be the key. But Paul Carrington was saying that as he's going around the PGA Tour, players, experienced players will come up to him and say, why wasn't the Pro-Am on this year?
Right.
Because, and I asked JP Manus, like, why have you still got so much, sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
Influence.
Yeah. Why? Have you, and he's like, oh, we treat the wives and kids so well. So we organise, when they come over, they get to see the best of Ireland. And they have this unbelievable 2 or 3 days.
For a man's world, Nathan, and I appreciate it is in many ways, what people underestimate is that women control the market.
Mm.
Women make 80% of all household decisions and purchases.
So they come over here
and JP's a smart man.
So, I've been dragged around to the Phoenix Open and I have to sit here and stay in this crappy hotel. And then I go and stay in the plushest, the best shopping experience, you name it.
Yeah.
So, like, Harrington was pointing out about just the level of players who he's able. So Tiger's played in the last two.
Yeah.
The expectation is that a lot of these younger players will come as well.
Yeah.
Telling them not to get the early flight back. So it's on a Monday and Tuesday. There's a 7 a.m. flight back to America. I think there's a 7 p.m. flight.
Yeah.
And he's like, the Americans are like, oh, get back early, you know.
Yeah.
No. Don't. The party is still going.
Okay.
At 7 a.m. He was talking about bringing, was it Tiger Woods or some other very experienced golfer over to Michael Flatley at 5 o'clock in the morning to get Michael Flatley to teach this golfer how to Irish dance after Harrington having previously shown him.
Right. Okay.
Which is not surprising.
The course is amazing then.
Yeah, the course is amazing. You can watch the four lads. So on the so I played on the Thursday and then the Friday as a follow-up. They let Rory McIlroy, Patrick Harrington, Shane Lowry and Paul McGinley play.
Mm.
JP McManus put up 500 grand for charity.
For the long strive?
No, for the winners of the four ball.
Okay, God. We're seeing it here. We're streaming this and we're on YouTube, so you can watch it back. So you this is you taking a video of the four of them too.
Oh yeah, I'm a multimedia journalist, Joe.
Good man.
So I just stood behind them with my camera and got the good shots.
And did you click on the downswing?
Of course.
Yeah.
And a little shout as well. Four swing is just the sweetest.
Oh, you can hear that if you're listening.
I also drove it straight down the fairway on the first.
Is that right?
I drove the ball, Joe, unlike I've ever driven the ball before.
It's not fair making Paul McGinley go straight after Rory McIlroy. That's just not fair.
This one's gonna look like slow motion.
That's a good line. If you didn't hear it in the podcast, you said this one's gonna look like slow motion.
So it was
everyone's thoughts exactly.
It was McIlroy and McGinley against Lowry and Harrington. Winners got 350 grand.
This is gonna be like watching a normal person swing compared to Rory McIlroy. God, yeah, it looks like. Oh, no, it's still pretty good. Sorry, that's a bit harsh on McGinley. It's still very good. Was Rory's the most impressive by a distance?
Yes.
Yeah.
Always is.
Yeah.
But Shane Lowry obviously has a
bit of. Shane Lowry can get it out there.
Nice bit of power.
Sneaky long, yeah. 300 yards, plenty of the time.
But yeah, Rory. It's just Rory's posture. Everything about it is so impressive.
So did you just follow the four of them around for a few holes kind of thing? It doesn't look like the place is that crowded.
No, so you weren't. There was no public entrance. It was members and some members' guests.
Okay.
And that was it. So I'd say it was 500 people.
Just following the four around.
walking down to the first tee, met Keith Wood and AP McCoy, those kind of people.
That's a great day.
So it was competitive enough, though they did give a birdie, 8-footer, to Harrington and Lowry on the last so that they would share the money.
Right. We've just seen Harrington launch one there. That's very nice to see. So you were speaking to Tom Fazio. Who is Tom Fazio?
Tom Fazio is one of, if not the most famous golf course architect in the world. He has more courses in Golf Digest's top 100 greatest golf courses than any other golf architect. Probably better known for his redesigns. So he's so Adara Manor was a brilliant golf course already.
It was Harrington's favorite course. Already.
It was the highest ranked parkland course in Ireland already.
Yeah.
Which is why now it's probably been taken to the highest ranked parkland course in Europe.
Yeah.
All because I think of the green structures, the amount of money are it's very Augusta-like.
They
it's
have being the Sub-Air, described as the... They have the Sub-Air system.
So they have the Sub-Air system and they have put in 250,000 tons of sand over the entire course. So it's like a Lynx course in a parkland setting.
Okay.
So the drainage is just out of this world. So no matter... We played there, the conditions were lovely on Thursday, but we've had 6 months of solid rain.
Yeah.
There wasn't an ounce of water.
Yeah.
On the course. So yeah, I spoke to Tom Fazio, who designed this course and who worked in conjunction with Patrick Harrington on designing it and getting the finishing touches. So yeah, here's how it went.
JP asked me about looking at changing some bunkers and fixing some drainage and different things in bunkers. And by the time we started looking in detail hole by hole, and again, parkland golf is very distinctive and unique. And certainly this was one of the wonderful parkland golf courses. And my feeling was that if we can somehow combine some of the great aspects of Lynx golf, that's why people come to Ireland and play Lynx golf, visitors per se. If we can add a piece of that into a parkland setting, wouldn't that be an interesting thing? So it was almost like cocktail talk. You know, let's have a pint and talk about it. So that evolved into the process of, yes, let's add some Lynx style play into a parkland setting. Hence, we evolved into what we have today.
What was Patrick Harrington's involvement?
Well, Patrick was, he was my key guy for an ally because I knew he could help me talk JP into doing it.
So as much as the technical side, it was the political side of things.
Oh, it's always right. And Patrick is a very smart guy and serious and understands golf, obviously. He's a great player. He actually helped. It wasn't that JP didn't believe what I had to say, but I think for me it was having another voice to help JP make a decision, because it was not an easy decision to make. I mean, he liked this golf course. He had some very successful charity events here, and people love it. This is considered one of the great parkland golf courses in golf. And so to say we're going to tear it up and rebuild it totally was not easy to accept to start with. So I figured Patrick could help me talk him into that.
So as you mentioned there, initially Tom Fazio was brought over by JP McManus to look at the course and see, can we make some subtle improvements? They had a lot of water gathering in some of the bunkers. How do we sort out that mess? 80, 90 million euro later, they end up with the best golf course in Europe. So 200 acres of land with a foot of sand under it now. They have 15, 16 inches of sand under every green with that sub-air system that they have at Augusta as well. Tom Fazio was saying that he's not in the business of no. Doesn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
And
lack
I put
of imagination surrounding no's.
Well, I'm saying, like, he sort of lives in the dream factory when
sometimes
it comes to this
room
type
to improve,
of thing.
You should go 80 million hour budget.
Well, this is why you watch Room to Improve. Tom Fazio would love Room to Improve, I'm sure.
Yeah, because Dermot Bannon, even when they say to him, Dermot, we've sold our children, 100 grand is the budget. He comes back and he says, you could have all this. And he shows it to them and their eyes light up and they think, oh my God, I can't believe we can have this. It's 158 grand. And then they have to go and steal 58 grand from their family and beg and plead. But they always do.
Well, somebody said to me at dinner that Tom Fazio was the only man who could blow an unlimited budget.
Yeah.
And I put that to Tom Fazio and Tom Fazio said, that's totally unfair. And I thought he was going to turn on me. And he said, I don't work with people who have budgets.
How do you get that job?
I know. And he looked around. He was like, you couldn't build something like this if you had a budget. If you had somebody over your shoulder saying, actually, I think we'll cap it at that.
Cut that corner.
No, there was no corners cut.
God, I can't wait to see it now.
just the, oh, it's the most beautiful golf course to look at.
Really?
And then the greens are, Harrington was saying the fastest greens in Europe. Both Harrington and Lowry were saying that it's the one place, which they both brought up, I think, previously, of being at home and practicing, that they don't like practicing in Ireland. One of the reasons Shane enjoys living in Florida now is that actually it doesn't feel like a chore going out.
Yeah, and they can have the course in tournament conditions because of the weather.
So they were both saying, they were having a discussion of, which we could just drive down here and actually get a golf course in tournament condition with greens of PGA Tour standard in competition setting. Mm. So, yeah, it's of that level. Now, it's not for everyone, Joe.
Right.
Green fees, €340.
Ouch.
The most expensive in Ireland.
You don't want it to rain.
You have to have a caddy, which is a huge advantage. Played my best golf in a long time, I think, because I had my caddy and actually had to concentrate.
I think we all would if they...
Well, also, there was the fifth hole, I think, is a... It's a long par four uphill, and I had a nice drive down the middle of the fairway, and he was just hit that as far left as you possibly can, and it's going to roll right down. And I just drilled a 3 wood up, and I was like, oh, that's gone way too far left.
Yeah.
And I walked up, and I had like 6 foot for birdie.
Great, isn't it?
4 putts later, I left that green quite angry at myself.
I think the caddies giving you advice like that actually focuses your mind. It takes away doubts or thoughts or question marks. We've just seen Harrington hit some shots there for those of you who aren't streaming. And like, you know, just hit it left. That, I think that focuses the mind a little bit. I think
well, I never would have known. I wouldn't have had a clue to hit it there.
Yeah.
So caddies, another £55 plus tip. You're looking at €450 before you hit a shot.
Right.
So...
You really need to be playing well with people you like and the weather needs to be good. And even then, some people will say, well, that's just too rich for my blood. And that's very understandable. Mm. Like golf, look, we can't deny it. Golf is an exclusive game. It's a rich man's game. And
this is a very, 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 very rich man's game.
Yeah.
What I would say is to any of our very, very rich American listeners who are coming over and would like some company.
Yeah.
The pod is always willing to go down to Adair Manor.
And meet the people.
And meet the people. That is the one time we will definitely get out there.
Quick mention, Padraig Harrington, by the way, says he wants to succeed Thomas Bjorn as European Ryder Cup captain for 2020 at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin. He wants to be an away-from-home captain. He said, it'd be good timing for me, 2020, for sure, in terms of where I'll be in my career. He says, by then, I'll probably be back playing in Europe. So, look, Padraig Harrington, vice-captain twice, played 6 times as a player, 3-time major winner, European golfing royalty, and he's going to be a bloody good captain anyway. He can basically dictate when he is captain. So he's decided it's going to be 2020. I'd be shocked if it's not him.
Yeah, he's been asked about 2026, obviously, and his relationship with Adair Manor and his relationship with JP McManus. And he was making the point that it's too long. I'm going to be too old compared to... There's probably be players in that team who'd be the same age as his kids.
Yeah.
Now, he could still do it. I'd imagine Harrington is going to keep his hand in for the next, 8 years away from that. If he wants to be captain in 2020, he'll be captain in 2020. Yeah. And also... I would say he is the most well-known European golfer.
In the States?
In the States, aside from Rory. Of that level, like who are the other?
Sergio.
Westwood, Sergio. I think Harrington even...
Sergio won the
Masters.
There's
certainly a warmth towards Harrington.
There is. There's the Irish-American thing as well. I'm conscious we're dragging on here and there's a few bits to touch on. So I just wanted to mention this. This is a mad story in Pennsylvania where a golf club has had to apologise for calling police on a group of black women. The co-owner and his father said they were playing too slowly and refused requests to leave the course. I felt we were discriminated against, said one of the women afterwards. After the second hole, a white man whose son co-owned the club came up to them twice and said they weren't keeping up pace with play. They felt they were, but they even skipped the third hole to avoid any other issues. They didn't want a big deal. At the ninth, they took a break, as was customary, and the men behind them said they weren't going fast enough again, but those men weren't ready to play off, said the women. They were drinking beers and the police were called. And shockingly, the golf course has since said, the police turned up and said, there's no charge here. Believe it or not, there's no charge here. So the golf course, under a lot of pressure, we sincerely apologize to the women for making them feel uncomfortable here at Grand View. That was not our intention in any way.
By calling the police.
Yeah. And even at the ninth, there were a group of five. I don't know, it's strange to me there were five playing, but 3 of the 5 left because they were just that uncomfortable with the general atmosphere. And so they were only going to play on with 2.
It's understandable.
So, shocking story there in Pennsylvania. But hey, listen. So Zurich Classic's on, Harrington and Lowry playing together. The favourites for this are, Stenson and Rose, Ryder Cup dream. You've Cawley and Thomas. You've Spieth and Palmer. Interesting, Spieth and Reid don't hook up for these things.
Spieth and Thomas.
Spieth and Palmer together. Spieth and Patrick Reid often play together in the Ryder Cup.
I would have thought though Spieth and Reid would play, or Spieth and Thomas would play together.
Yeah, would have thought so. Watson and Kuchar are together. Cabrera-Bello and Garcia are playing together. McDowell is playing with Poulter.
Oh yeah, they were getting the private jet over together.
Is that right? Snedeker and JB Holmes, and on it goes. Schwartz.
I think Harrington and Lowry are a decent price at 60-1 for what is an unusual tournament where, all right, the best team may not necessarily win.
Yeah. Paul Dunne is 7 shots off the lead after Ren 1 at the China Open. You can keep an eye on that. As I'm, as we're about to wrap this up, Michael Brennan has tweeted me, or tweeted at Golf Weekly OTB, any pod this week, Lance? Or is Fionn covering the royal birth and Joe too busy with his motorbike?
Oof.
I'd say Nathan's up for it. Well, screw you, Michael Brennan. You've got to mention right at the end. Let's see if you hear it.
Wow.
After all your moaning. He better listen to the end now.
So we have one more interview to bring you.
Yeah.
Stephanie Meadow, who is our leading female golfer in Ireland. She actually won within the last fortnight on the secondary tour. So she has dropped out of the LPGA tour, as you're going to hear.
Right.
She's had a lot going on in her life over the last few years. So she's gone back to what's the equivalent of the web.com.
Okay.
So she won her second event. She won the second event of the season on that just a couple of weeks ago.
Stephanie moved over very young, didn't she?
14.
Because her family, parents wanted her to have the best chance.
Yeah, her parents obviously realised that there wasn't a huge opportunities for young female golfer in Ireland. And she has that brilliant confidence that I want to send my kids to America when they're 14.
So they don't hate themselves.
So eloquent, so confident. Yeah. They can talk about life in a normal way.
I know. They don't feel...
Where's the self-doubt?
They don't feel... Like, even when I was in New York, it took me 2 or 3 days to, like, stop muttering and to make eye contact with people. You know, they're just better at that than us. They're like, hey, how are you? They're so open. And we're kind of lacking in confidence and twisted, dark people. Drink a lot. So are we saying goodbye here?
We're saying goodbye, and we're going to play this interview. This is Stephanie Meadow. Really interesting. Enjoy.
Great. I've heard good things about this. We'll see you next week, Stephanie Meadow. And are we back next week?
Yes.
I am. Okay. We'll do something next week for sure. So Nathan, in conversation here with Stephanie Meadow.
All right. We're here at Grange Golf Club in South Dublin. I'm delighted to be joined by Irish Olympic golfer Stephanie Meadow. How are you?
Hi. Good. Thanks. How are
Welcome
you?
Home. It's been a while, has it?
Oh, yeah. It's always great to come home and kind of get the Irish back in me. And it's always fun.
And you're coming home as a winner.
Yes. Which is even better. I won my last event and it's kind of the first win for me in a little while. So it really feels good that hard work's paying off.
Yeah. So tell us where you are in your career then, because we all stood up and took notice at the US Open back almost 4 years ago now, when you went so close to winning, and again at the Olympics. What level are you playing at the moment?
So right now I'm on the Symetra Tour, which is the equivalent of the web.com. So, you know, which is obviously a big change for me. I played on the LPGA for 3 years. And
so that's one step down from the main
tour. One
step
down, yeah. So, you know, I lost my card. I had an L5 stress fracture last year that kind of knocked me off. And, I kind of lost my game. But it's coming back around, thankfully. And it's the best I've played probably since 2014. So it's great news.
Was it a bit of a shock to the system having to move down a level, considering you blaze such a trail at first coming in at the US Open? Was that your first professional start?
Yes, first professional start.
Finishing third at a major. Everybody thinks from here on in, it's an upward trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, sport isn't like that.
Mm-mm.
What happened after the US Open?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit of a shock to the system when you start that fast. You're on the kind of headlines and a lot of pressure, and I just kind of lost a little bit. And then my dad passed away in 15, and I took a break from golf while he was sick to spend time with him. And it just never really came back after that. You know, mentally I just wasn't the same person. And you know, obviously losing my dad, who was such a big influence on my golf career and my life in general, was really hard. So it's been a journey, you know. It's full of ups and downs, just like any sport or any career. And you know, thankfully I'm on the up again.
Yeah, talk to us about your dad, because as you say, such a huge influence. And he took a huge step as well when he realized your potential. You all moved to America at a very young age. When did the love of golf start, and how important was he in that?
Huge. I mean, that was the reason. Basically, he was a golfer. My mom was a equestrian, horse rider. And for a while when I was younger, I was doing both. And then I fell off the horse, and that was that. Yeah.
Right, no going back.
Yeah, no going back. So, basically, he would take lessons on, you know, at weekends, and I would go with him as kind of babysitting. And than I wanted
to
be.
Where did you play out up in Northern Ireland?
So I was taking lessons at Ballyearl at the beginning, and so it turned into my lesson. Like, it became, I want to go, and so then it became all of my lesson. And then a guy called Jim Robinson, who was the head pro at Ballyearl for a long time before he moved down here, told me to go to Ballyclare Golf Club, where they had Friday girl group, and there was about 30 girls that got together and putted and chipped and had lessons. So that was kind of, you know, it really all started, and I just loved the game from there.
And was your dad a mid-handicapper, a sort of weekend warrior out in the Saturday and Sunday, or was he someone who took the game quite seriously?
No, a weekend warrior, yeah. He was, you know, mid-teens, and he had some great days, but he always said, he said, oh, by the time she was 11, she was already kicking my butt. So, yeah, I think that was kind of a lot of pride for him too, yeah.
And what age then did you realize that you were a little bit better than everybody else?
I think I was around 11, and I played in the Irish Girls Close, and I finished runner-up, and that was kind of my first year in that scene, and that came of a bit of a shock. But then I kind of realized, okay, I'm pretty good at this. I want to do better and get more out of it. And then when I was 14, obviously, we made the decision to move to the States to go to a golf academy. And, you know, very, very lucky that my parents had the opportunity to be able to do that with me.
So the whole family up and left.
Yep. Yeah. When I look back on it now, I'm like, wow, that was amazing. Like, what a, you know, kind of leap of faith. But my parents, you know, they supported me in any way they could. And that's what they thought was best. And
like,
I wanted to do
it. Slightly different to, say, a lot of the male golfers who we know who went to college in America, who go at 18, 19. Mm-hmm. Leaving at 14, so you're heading over there to high school.
Yes, Yeah, I did 4 years of high school, and basically, you know, did school from 7:30 to 12:30, and then the rest of the day was golf. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Is there a pressure with that when you're 14? Like, how do those conversations happen when you're 13, 14 with your parents as to whether you want to make that step? Because ultimately, as you say, your parents are giving up their jobs, I assume, giving up a huge amount.
Yeah.
And suddenly all the pressure of family life is on you delivering.
I don't remember that much about it. I remember that I'd gone over to the States at Christmas time, and that's where we vacationed most Christmases, and I played a golf tournament over there, and I saw a girl with the IJGA, and then I saw David Ledbetter School on their bags, and I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. I remember saying, well, that would be fun to go to, and I just was all about, I mean, I'm 14, I love golf, I'm like, okay, yeah, I definitely, let's do it. And I mean, I don't remember any conversation where, you know, it's like super intense or anything. I just knew that they wanted to provide the best for me, and that's what they thought was good.
Was it the Ledbetter School you went to then?
No, I actually went to IJGA, so International Junior Golf Academy, who Gary Kilchrist was the coach when I first got there, and then he left, and then Hank Haney came. But those were...
What did he ever do?
Yeah, I know, yeah. But those were... you know, kind of names of the school. So they just came in once a month, that kind of thing. So I had other coaches that were with me every day, and, you know, incredible coaching. I learned so much when I went out there.
And was everybody there of a similar age group?
Ability? Yeah. No, not similar ability. You know, there was a lot anywhere from beginners to, you know, my level or better. And that's one thing I did learn when I went over there. You know, I kind of left Ireland being pretty top, and then I went to America, and I was like, okay, I'm an absolute nobody. but that's good. You know, it makes you focus and be motivated to be better, and, you know, I think that helped me a lot.
As you got older then, you had maybe conversations with your parents about how that move came about. Mm-hmm. Was it partly as them thinking, actually, we're moving to America, maybe a better life for everybody?
Yeah, I think they...
That even if the golf doesn't work out for you, that actually for them, heading into their later years, this is all right.
They liked it, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, you know, they always vacationed there. They loved America, and we actually vacationed in Hilton Head, which is where the school was. So, you know, they knew the area, and they really liked it. So I think it worked out well for both parties.
Yeah. Were you very self-motivated during those times? Like, was the dream to get onto the LPGA Tour? Mm-hmm. When did you start thinking thoughts like that?
Yeah, when I was very young. I mean, I always knew that LPGA was where I wanted to be. And, you know, it's hard because nobody else from here had kind of done it before. A lot of girls have been maybe LET and then dropped off, but nobody had really gotten that far. So the path wasn't that clear. But
so where do you even learn about that? Like, are you up on a Sunday night watching it? Few tournaments that they covered in Sky?
Yeah, I think so. And watching Annika, you know, she was the biggest role model kind of at that point time. I mean, she won 10 majors and 74 tournaments, and that's you know, played a PGA Tour event and shot 59. So, I mean, how can you not love her?
So. Yeah. So that was the real aspiration then. Mm-hmm. Heading to college then, like, we know that so many sports people from here rave about the college experience in America if you're a sports person. And we were just talking about Title IX. And for somebody in what's somewhat seen as a minority sport in terms of numbers in America, for a female golfer, there are huge benefits.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, female golf gets 7 full scholarships a year. So basically, you know, if you're really good at, I mean, you could go to a great school if you're really good, or even if you're just kind of like average and you don't want to turn pro, you can still go to a really good school and get a full ride. You know, you get tuition paid for, books paid for, you get, you know, rent expenses, and, you know, it's just, it's a pretty cool opportunity to do something you love and get your education at the same time.
Where did you go?
I went to the University of Alabama. So it's a big school, massive football school, American football school. So there's a lot of money. That's what brings in the money for athletic departments is American football. And so we had every opportunity you could ever imagine to succeed there.
Okay, so that's where it evens itself out. If they're, how many players would they have in their football role?
Oh, 100 plus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they have to have 100 plus female athletes on a similar scholarship.
Exactly, yeah. So Title IX is an amazing opportunity for female athletes. You know, it gives us huge chances to make it.
It also means that the level of competition then, because people aren't turning professional, by and large, when they're 17 or 18, they're happy to go through the entire college process.
Yes.
And I think we probably see that at the moment with Leona Maguire, and people are wondering, as the world's best amateur, why she isn't turning professional sooner. Actually, it's a very good competitive life in college, aside even from the educational side of things.
Yeah, there's so many great schools, and we travel all over the country and compete against the best. I mean, all you do is learn at that level, and I think it's very important. You know, you learn how to be an adult, and you learn, you know, how are you going to handle being a pro, and those things are vital. You know, those are a big part of our professional careers, and I got so much experience from being at college. And And the other thing is, you get an education, you know, you get a degree if you finish. And
what were you studying?
Yeah, I did accounting. So, pretty
the
hard.
The Patrick Harrington route.
Yeah, the Patrick Harrington route, yeah. I kind of, you know, last year was pretty tough, you know, senior classes and trying to combine that with golf as well. But, you know, you can't have anything better than a backup plan like that. And it takes a lot of pressure off, you know, the golf side of things too, you know, because you just don't know. I've had my injuries, you know, what happens if that could have been career ending, and then what? So I just think it's an all around great experience for young girls and guys to do.
Yourself and Leona have been the real trailblazers for female golfers in this country. And both of you gone a similar route, having to go to America. Do you think, is it possible for a young Irish golfer to stay in this country?
Yeah.
And progress? Like, are we still that far behind in terms of investment?
No, I think it's a lot closer now than it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, for sure. Coaching's gotten a lot better. The facility's gotten better. You know, Team Ireland Golf are extremely supportive. They've been supporting me since I turned pro, which is, you know, we're extremely lucky to have that. Now, you know, Americans don't get that. They don't have any sort of funding
like that. So you're on the carding
like
system,
that.
Are you? Mm-hmm. In terms you get? You get a certain amount every
certain
year,
amount
depending
year.
On what you can achieve.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it's a huge help because, you know, sponsors are not easy to come by in women's golf, and thankfully I have a few very supportive ones, which is amazing. You know, Team Ireland and Vestech, you know, it's just great to have them behind me.
Mm. The LPGA Tour just seems to be going from success to success at the moment, and the prize funds are rising all the time, and it's getting more and more coverage.
Yeah.
It's pretty much in contrast to what's happening, unfortunately, on the Ladies European Tour. And I think a lot of people remember back to the time of the Solheim Cup, and we had a Ladies Irish Open, and they were getting huge crowds down to Killeen Castle, and it built up to something, and then it just very much died a death, that there was no one really to carry on.
Like,
is your long-term future in America? Are you looking at European Tour golf and ladies golf in Europe and sort of shaking your head, wondering what the hell's going on?
Yeah, it's a tough situation for them. You know, they're losing a lot of tournaments, and their prize money, unlike ours, is just going downhill. But, you know, if you want to be on the main stage, you got to be in the LPGA. And yeah, most of our events are in these states, but there's a lot in Asia now, and there's a few kind of over here. you know, we have the Scottish Open, which is now an LPGA event, and you know, hopefully at some point we can get the Irish Open back, because, you know, people in Ireland love golf, and I think they should be able to see us women compete as well as the men, and I think they would enjoy that.
And that was sort of proven around those couple of years around the Solheim Cup, that if you put on a well-organized event and you get the publicity right and you put the marketing budget behind it, people will come. They just need to know about it.
Exactly, yeah. And that's, I mean, that's a great thing about Ireland, you know. They're very supportive people, and, you know, fingers crossed that we can hopefully get something like that sorted out again, and I'll definitely be here when it happens.
So you were talking there about Annika Sörenstam and the incredible success she enjoyed. When you finished third in the US Open, do you suddenly your ambitions, your goals start changing? Like, if that's your first professional event, like, I don't know, what were your thoughts when you were teeing it up at the US Open that week, and so what the next couple of years looked like, and how did they change afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think I'd thought that. I mean, I'd always wanted to be, you know, well up there in the rankings before I turned pro, and I was just so excited when I got to the US Open that I was finally pro. You know, college was amazing experience, but I was also ready. You know, I was like, okay, I'm ready to do this now.
Bank account is open.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But when you finish third, you know, it's like, okay, I can compete every week and I can do this, and I almost want a major, and what else can I do? And your expectations go pretty high pretty fast, and everybody else's expectations of you go really high as well. And, you know, it's kind of a hard thing to swallow too. I mean, I will, you know, you learn a lot from that. You learn how to manage your expectations, and how to not get distracted from, you know, you got to stick to your process and not get so wrapped up in the results of everything. And, you know, I've learned a lot in these past 3 years. It's not exactly how I pictured it, because it's been mostly this way after that, but now I'm on the up again, and hopefully I can draw on those experiences when and if that happens again.
Was it almost too much too soon, that if you go out in your first professional tournament and you contend at a major, do you think, actually, geez, I have made it? Maybe it's something subconscious, maybe it's not something you're walking around strutting. Yeah. But actually something in you thinks, yeah, well, I know I can compete. I just did it at one of the biggest tournaments of the year.
Yeah, it's definitely, your mind races way ahead of where it should be, I think. But, yeah, I'll never take it back. I mean, that was the best experience, one of the best experiences of my life. I mean, to be third in the US Open straight out of school, so many people supporting me. And, I mean, the support I got from Ireland, like, I cannot tell you how many text messages I had after that. My phone died within, like, 10 minutes because it was just constantly going. So, you know, I'll never take it back, and it was a great way to start my career, and that's what I had dreamed of since I was a little girl. You know, being in contention in a major, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that, no matter what else happened.
It must have been a brilliant thing as well for your parents and for your dad to have had that before he passed, to get to see you and to realize everything, and all the risks that they took and all the sacrifices that were made, that actually,
I think about that a lot, actually, you know, because that was very early, obviously, in my professional career. My dad wasn't around for that long of my career, and professionally, and for him to see that and be so proud and kind of see that, you know, they put a lot of hard work into this too. So it's very special for him to have that memory, and I'm so glad that it happened when he was still here.
How difficult is it then when your dad is ill and you're going through that, and as a professional sports person, people on the outside, they don't know, and they don't generally care because they don't know. Everyone's just looking at your results, and you're judged. Your identity is forged so much in your results on the golf course, and people don't really stop to ask what's happening.
Anything else,
Is that something you really noticed?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. You know, I had a lot of support from my friends on tour, for the players. I cannot tell you how many cards I got in my lockers the weeks after. But, you know, that was a really tough thing. You know, when my dad got diagnosed, he had pancreatic stage 4 cancer, stage 4B when it was diagnosed. So it's a brutal cancer. And, you know, I said to him, I was like, I'm not playing. I'm done. Yeah. You know, I only know, you know, average lifetime after that is 3 to 6 months. And I was like, I'm not going to spend the last 6 months traveling around and not being there. So, but I did play one event because I had gotten an exemption into a major, Craft Nabisco. And so that was the last event that my dad saw me play in. And no, it was pretty cool. I finished tied for 20th there. And when I think back on it, like, I hadn't practiced. I hadn't put much work in going into that tournament. I still felt really rusty and I played really well. But I guess, you know, I just knew that this is my last chance to kind of for dad to see me. And it was really amazing that, you know, I was actually covered on Golf Channel, and they actually talked about my dad in on the Golf Morning Drive on the Golf Channel. So, you know, it's cool for him to be, you know, sitting there watching that. You know, it's hard too to think about, but, you know, it's really amazing that he saw that.
Yeah. How long then until you could face going back on tour again? Because it is such a solitary existence. You have to leave the house and say, I'll be back in a month, I'll be back in 6 weeks' time. Yeah. You're probably staying in a cheap hotel somewhere trying to save a few quid.
Exactly.
It's not all glamour.
No, it's not. Definitely not like the man, the top man. Yeah, I actually decided to go out the week after we had the funeral in the States, and bad decision, very bad decision. You know, I guess I just wanted to go back out there and play for him. Yeah. That was kind of my mindset at that point.
It's hard not to make bad decisions.
Yeah, and, you know, so it was actually, where was it? I think it was in Canada. And I remember I had the same caddy for probably almost a year, and he could tell, you know, I was kind of getting it rough, and I looked across the fairway. I remember I was on the sixth hole and I was like one over par, and I looked across the fairway because I wasn't feeling that great about game, expecting my dad to be there, and that was it. Like, I just lost it.
In the middle of the round.
Yeah, in the middle of the round. Like, and thank God that I was playing with friends of mine, and they knew exactly what was going on, but I was just bawling in the middle of the round. And I finished out because that's kind of the person I am. And I got through it, and, you know, they actually played good, so thank goodness. I didn't want to be a distraction, but yeah, I quit after that. You know, I finished the round, and then I decided I need to go home. Like, I need to just digest and, you know, kind of look back and start to grieve.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I did that, and then, but I kept battling, played, but I just wasn't there. Like, mentally, I was physically there, but mentally just not the same person. And that took a long time.
Golf must be one of the most difficult sports as well, then, when you're getting back on track to get that balance right, because, you say, it's such a mental game, and you're so close to your dad, and he's so intertwined in everything that's happened in your career, that you want to go out and do it for him.
Yeah.
But actually having that emotion,
it's hard,
isn't really the best thing to have with you when you're teeing it up in a golf course.
Yeah, it's just a constant reminder. And that was the hardest part for me, was golf was the biggest reminder of my dad, and I couldn't focus. But, you know, I started to look at it and say, okay, well, this is great that I had that connection with my dad on the golf course, and I can feel close to him when I'm out there, and use that in a positive way, as instead of, you know, being absolutely completely torn up about it. You know, it never, the pain, it's always there, it's always hard, but it does get a little easier.
We're here at the Grange in South Dublin, which is the home course of Paul McGinley, who was the Olympic captain, and you got to go. You didn't worry about any Zika virus or anything like that.
Just
you went and played.
Yeah.
What was the Olympics like as an experience?
Oh, it was fantastic. Definitely top three experiences of my lifetime. You know, the golf tournament was kind of the same as normal, with LPGA ran it, so the same officials were there and that sort of thing. But, you know, outside of that, completely different. You know, going to dinner at night at the dining halls and seeing all these different athletes, and you just people watch, just sit there, like, you know, what sport do they play, where are they from, you know, trade badges.
Who were you most impressed with?
Probably all the swimmers that like seeing them. Yeah. But yeah, we got to go to a lot of events. I saw Michael Phelps swim for the last time the first night I got there. Watched Irish badminton, did a ton of things, and it was just such an amazing experience. And you know, no one can take that away from me.
McGinley seemed to bring the meticulous detail and planning that he showed with the Ryder Cup so successfully to the Olympics, because quite often when we look at who's the Olympic golf manager, it's such an individual sport, you gotta go do your own thing. What has he really got to do except make sure you all turn up in the tee on time?
Yeah.
But it was clear right from the off that wasn't going to be the way that McGinley approached this. That he had gone out to Rio, I think, a couple of times to look at the course. What was it like being part of that close-knit team then with Patrick Harrington, with Seamus Power, with Paul McGinley?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. You know, when I got there, the men's event was just finishing, so we got to hang out with Seamus and Patrick a little bit. And Paul mainly he's just so enthusiastic, and it made it so much better, you know, to be a part of that. He wanted us to go to events at night. He wanted us to experience the Olympics, you know. And everything was planned to a T for us. We didn't have to worry about anything, which was amazing.
I think he got that it was an Olympic experience for ye as well, because so much of the talk heading into it around golf was, well, this is a professional sport. It's all about the money.
Yeah.
Do they need to be at the Olympics?
Do
they deserve that sort of feeling? But actually, for so many people going over there, and it's the same feeling as being an athlete. It's the same feeling as being a swimmer.
Yeah.
wearing the green jersey, mm-hmm. being an Olympian for Ireland, we would talk to Gary O'Toole, the former swimmer, and he said, you know, you're never a former Olympian. You're always just
an Olympian. Yeah,
and you
exactly.
always have that now.
Yeah, which is amazing. You know, and it's a weird thing because growing up, I obviously never thought about it. I never thought I could be an Olympian. And then when it started happening and first started talking to Paul and he was telling me, you know, you're pretty close to, you know, world ranking wise of getting in. And I'm like, wow, like this is really cool, you know? To say Stephanie Meadow, the Olympian, yeah, I never thought that was going to be possible. So, yeah, very close to my heart.
And you're thinking about 2020 already?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It'll be very exciting. And, hopefully I'll be back there.
So, obviously, confidence is very high now coming mm-hmm. in after a win in the last couple of weeks. The second tier, can you sustain a living out of that? Or is it something you put yourself through for a year, hope that it all flicks around, and then you get yourself back in the LPGA Tour and that's where life becomes comfortable again? Is it a proper old grind out on the second tier?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a grind. You know, I think the biggest battle is just trying to keep the expenses down as much as I can. You know, if you play good on the Symetra, like top three, you can probably make close to $100,000, which is really good.
Okay.
So the prize money has gone up dramatically. But, you know, I decided not to kind of take a full-time caddy this year. You don't have to have a caddy on Symetra. It's just something that I think I can buckle down and do by myself for a year. And I'll have a few people come in and out occasionally for me, you know, for five or six events. So I have to do about 10 on my own. But, you know, it's just part of it. You know, I believe I'll be fine by myself.
Yeah. What are the aspirations then for the next 2-3 years?
Back on LPGA and hopefully get where I think I belong, which is, you know, at least top 50 and top 20, you know.
Where do you think you belong?
Definitely, you know, I'd love to be top 20, but I've always wanted to be the number one player in the world. And obviously that's taken a little bit of a turn here and there, but, you know, that's still always my aspiration and that's what I work for. That's what gets me up in the morning. So, you know, I'll never forget that.
Coming through at Alabama, you would have played against and played alongside a lot of those golfers who are in the top 50 in the world right now. Do you look at them and see, well, why their career has gone this way and why mm-hmm. yours has just stuttered over the last couple of years?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to watch. But, you know, that's just how golf is. It's a tough sport and you got to have a well-rounded balance of everything to make it, you know, you got to have that to succeed. And, you know, I watch them and I guess that gives me confidence too, because I know, you know, in college I beat them, so there's no reason why I can't beat them now.
Yeah. Great to talk to you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Enjoy your trip home.
Thank you.
Tell all my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket down. Starter kit right here.